unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Tonight we are starting a month-long exploration loosely based on Norman Fisher's book, What is Zen? This book is a conversation between two old friends, Susan Moon, writer and long-term practitioner who is asking questions, and Norman, who is sharing his responses. I would like to say a bit more about Norman Fisher for those who do not know him. Zoketsu Norman Fisher is the Dharma heir of Sochun Mel Weitzman, from whom he received transmission in 1988. He served as co-abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, and he founded Everyday Zen Foundation in 2000. For many years, he was the guiding teacher of this Sangha until he stepped back and Nomon Tim Burnett became the guiding teacher. So this book, What is Zen? Is a little bit like what we will attempt tonight. John and I will share our experiences around form and ritual. And then we will invite you to ask questions and share your views on form and ritual. Here we go. I gave it away. We will discuss form and ritual.
She's form, I'm ritual.
Almost everybody's favorite practice or stumbling point, depending on when you ask. Sooner or later, we are either wanting more of it or less of it. Chants, bowing, formal oryoki meals, more of this and less of that, or the other way around. Oh no, service was changed again. Someone retranslated my favorite chant. And what are they doing now? If you have been coming here for a while, this may sound familiar, and you might have an opinion about it, one way or the other. If we ask the internet, we will find Zen everything. Sushi bars, body care products, spas, books on better golfing, and the Zen of making more money. And yet, we might get a taste of the freedom, the gift of fearlessness. Because among the many hits, there will be some good books about Zen practice, invitations to meditate. There will be research on the benefits of mindfulness. We will find crazy stories of Zen masters hitting each other and asking incomprehensible questions with answers that are equally strange. Or we might read or hear talks from teachers. That describes, from what I hear, the entry into practice for many of us. That was definitely me in the beginning. So finally, we make it to a place of Zen, a Zendo temple, somebody's living room, our heads full of enlightenment stories, Zen encounters, meditation experiences vaguely promised to happen at some time. And this is what happens next: orientation. Bow when you enter the hall. Bow to your seat. Sit down. Turn to the right. Take the seat. be aware, count your breath. And don't let me start the service. Prostrations, chanting, a priest, more prostrations. This sounds so much like the church I just escaped from. And wasn't there a commandment about not bowing to idols? My mom still thinks I'm going to go to hell. So what am I doing here? Yeah. What are we doing here? Why all this bowing and turn to the right when you get up and fluffing your cushion at the end of Zazen? Those crazy Zen stories don't talk about that. Well, here comes the bad news. Those Zen stories actually indirectly talk about it. They talk about abbots and monks, about life in a Zen monastery, which is pretty much outside of prison the most restrictive environment I know. We did inherit many of the forms from our Zen ancestors from India, China, and Japan, and we are choosing bits and pieces of it to put our own Zen, American Zen together. Please don't confuse it with Japanese Zen or what you might experience in Japan if you go to a temple, to service. It's very different. Some of these bits and pieces we adopted, like I said, are form and ritual, transformed and in many cases somewhat softened up to fit in with our American lay life. You may still ask, but why? Forms and rituals are part of the Zen magic. I know you came here to find peace and calm, and instead you got form and ritual. What happened? Because that peace and calm, at least the Zen version of it, is happening in this framework. When within this framework, being still and quiet, non-reactive, I can actually see my resistance, which I might not if I was acting out on it. I see what and how I feel. Norman Fisher answered Sue Moon's question why we put so much emphasis on doing things a certain way and whether Zen might just be a little obsessive compulsive. So I will read you a little bit from the book. So here is Sue Moon's question. Why do we put so much emphasis on doing everything a certain way? What difference does it really make whether you sit Zazen with your right or your left hand on top? Whether you rest your spoon in your first or second bowl during an Orioki meal? Isn't Zen kind of obsessive compulsive? So this is Norman's answer. Maybe Zen can be a bit obsessive. I like to soften that and foster a relaxed feeling about how we do the forms. Maybe even simplify. After all, this is important. The forms are to facilitate practice and transformation. They are not eternal rules. But there's a point to doing things a certain way. In fact, one always does things a certain way. There is never no way. There is always some way. And there is always a degree of flexibility and creativity in how you interpret or apply the way you do things. In music, there are scales to learn and practice, very rigid. Why not just pick up the horn and tune in the way you feel like tooting? But no, there won't be music that way. Or anyway, there won't be Beethoven or Verdi. There is nothing absolute about left hand over right, or where you put your spoon on your bowl. It could have been some other way. There's also nothing absolute about the chromatic scale. It just happens to be the way our music works. Zen forms make sense. They have a feeling, an integrity, a history, a depth. They facilitate spiritual development in certain directions. But yes, it is also very important not to get so stuck on them that they become counterproductive, which can happen. So I had my own struggles with forms. I had some preferences. And so I tried out some other styles, some other types of meditation practice, only to find that, speaking for myself only, I missed the forms. That they brought awareness and mindfulness to practice in the Zendo and also to life outside the Zendo. The awareness of where my body is, what I am doing, when one thing ends and another one begins. So I have spent 3 residential practice periods in monasteries. So I'm going to exaggerate this a little bit. Let me compare a regular activity we all know, like taking a shower, and I'm going to compare it to what I do at Tassajara. And again, forgive my exaggerations and worst case scenarios. We all know what a shower is. After we've done some hard work and we're sweaty, we turn on the water, think about what we just did, what went right and what went wrong. And we think about the stuff we need to do after the shower. Appointment, shopping, gassing up the car. So while we're washing and scrubbing on autopilot, drying off, getting dressed, after what we figure out what to wear depending on where we go, we almost might miss the fact we just took a shower. At Tassajara, you take a short 5-minute hike to the bathhouse. At the entrance, you bow and light some incense. And there's a wooden plaque that says, "I vow with all beings to wash body and mind, free from dust, pure and shining within and without." The shower water is sometimes very hot and sometimes cool. Please enjoy the temperature you get because you cannot change it. There is soap and shampoo provided. And there's just this, the shower, the river behind the bathhouse, and the sun shining through the windows, or a winter storm barreling through and cold wind tearing through the bathhouse, because there are not too many windows there. And you get really cold when you take your shower, and there's just this, because you can't change the temperature, there's no heater. And then you put on your robes and you get ready for the evening meal at the Zendo, taken Orioki style. So this was the comparison, absolutely done without comparing mind. That was supposed to be a joke, sorry. I am not saying good or bad. I'm just saying we do have a choice. The choice sometimes is cramming down a sandwich while driving fast and being late. But we should know what we're doing. We should know that we're cramming down a sandwich while we're fast, driving too fast, and we're going to be late. It doesn't mean perfection. We should just be aware of it. Form and ritual are training devices to teach us about our life, not about forms. So here's another monastery example. Whenever we pass through a doorway, the foot closest to the hinge enters first. So this is not about hinges, it's about awareness. I am entering a different space. I am lifting my foot across the threshold. Be here. Be present for your life. And especially at Tassajara, it's really good to be aware that you enter a different space, because some of those thresholds are pretty high and have sharp edges. One learns rather quickly to be mindful of entering a new space. So I will end my portion of the talk with what my teacher said to Norman about bowing to the Buddha. And I really appreciated this one because it captures the spirit the way I feel about it. So Mel Weitzman said to Norman, "You bow to the Buddha. The Buddha bows to you," he told me, or words to that effect. The idea was, I think, that when you are bowing to the Buddha, you're not bowing to an external power. There are no external powers in Buddhism. You are, in fact, bowing to yourself, your true self, which is identical to the Buddha. So in a sense, your bowing is conditioning you to respect what is deepest and truest within you and in everything and in everyone else. So that's what form and ritual means to me. And I'll hand this over to John for part two.
Okay, well, welcome to part two, and I'm going to talk mostly about ritual. I also used Norman's book, Norman and Susan Moon's book, What is Zen? And then also a book called Bringing Zen Home by Paula Arai. It's the healing heart of Japanese women's rituals in Japan. And she spent over 10 years in Japan studying the rituals that women in Japan use at home to help with their, you know, most difficult life challenges. I found it quite interesting. But I thought I'd start out by just defining ritual, and this is the Oxford Dictionary definition, which defines ritual as an imitative or symbolic act designed to achieve some end, often of a supernatural character, and it usually comes from the ancient past and has been passed on and repeated over many, many generations. So that really does apply to the rituals we have here at Red Cedar. Most of them are inherited from our Chinese and Japanese ancestors. We have one or two that come from India from the time of the Buddha, but most of them come from China or Japan. And we practice them out of respect and gratitude for the effort that these ancestors made to develop the practice and to pass it on person to person to person for centuries until it came to us. And as Norman mentions in his book, there are two basic kinds of ritual. There's zendo, or meditation hall etiquette, and then there are also special ceremonies. So zendo, meditation hall etiquette, includes things like when you walk in the door, you bow. You bow to your cushion, you bow to the room, the particular way that we do walking meditation, the chanting and bowing that we do during service with the priest who's offering at the altar on behalf of all of us. And we carry out these rituals with the same calm and focus that we try to have on the cushion when we're meditating. And they help us move gracefully together through the zendo like one body. And they train us to pay attention off the cushion when we enter the life of movement, you know, to move carefully, to move precisely. And it might seem like a restriction to have to do things a certain way. You know, for new people especially, and I think there's a few new people here tonight, it must seem very odd, you know, like to, you know, to see what people are doing and not knowing what is going on and when do I bow and why am I bowing? What do these words mean that we chant in kind of imitation Japanese? So it's very challenging at first. There's so many details and a lot of opportunities to make mistakes. And even if you've been practicing a long, long time, the opportunities to make mistakes are always there. So one could feel alienated, but once you get a basic familiarity with the forms and you get more familiar with it, then there's really a beauty to doing things together, to bowing together, to moving through the meditation hall together. And there's kind of a feeling of community and also a connection to all the people who've been doing these forms for centuries. Once you have the basics down, you don't have to think about what to do or when to do it or how to do it. And that's really quite freeing, especially if you're in a meditation retreat. And I've always kind of chuckled at this because in my personal life, I really don't like to be told what to do or how to do it. I got a lot of that growing up and I just resist it. But I really actually find it wonderful here. And I tried some other forms of Buddhism where they really don't have any form or ritual. You can sit however you want, you can wear whatever you want. And it's so much more kind of peaceful and meditative in the Zen tradition. I really like it. We just finished a 7-day retreat at Samish Island, and it's a silent retreat. You don't talk hardly at all during the 7 days. And I was in the meditation hall sitting right next to a guy from Arizona who had never been to one of our retreats before. He didn't know anything about the rituals. And after the retreat was over and we could talk to each other, he came up to me and he said that it was really helpful to kind of watch what other people were doing and follow along. And once he got the hang of it, he didn't have to think about what to do. He could just do it. You might have to actually experience that during a meditation retreat, but it really is quite freeing. So, I mean, and then there are also, when we come back to ritual, the special rituals. Weddings and funerals are examples of that, whether they're Buddhist weddings and funerals or from some other tradition. And in Buddhism, we also have rituals like when someone makes a commitment to follow the precepts, they go through quite a bit of study and then do a ceremony called Jukai, where they take the precepts. We also have a ceremony to honor the Buddha's enlightenment, a ceremony to commemorate the Buddha's death, so things like that. And these kind of rituals can evoke... Oh, thank you. You can tell my voice is starting to struggle. These kind of rituals can evoke feelings that we all have, but when they're experienced as a group, they're all the more powerful. Just think about some of the weddings or funerals that you've been to. You know, the feeling of love, the feeling of connection, sometimes the reminder about what's really important in life. I certainly get that when I go to a funeral, when someone, you know, usually the life of the person who's died is reviewed a little bit, and you can't help but think about, you know, how am I living my life? You know, what really matters? We don't have forever. We're not going to be alive forever, so it's really important to think about how am I living my life, and these rituals can help us do that. So as I mentioned, now I'm going to talk a little bit about this book, Bringing Zen Home, The Healing Heart of Japanese Women's Rituals. Paula Arai is a professor of Buddhist studies. She was educated at Harvard. I'm not sure if she taught in New Orleans and she taught in Illinois, and I'm not sure where she's teaching now. But as I mentioned, she spent more than 10 years in Japan studying the rituals that, you know, civilian women in Japan use at home. These are not women who live in monasteries. And the women she studied ranged in age from their 40s to their 70s. Some were single, some married, some had children, some did not, some worked, some did not. So she covered a pretty wide range of lifestyles. And early in the book, she often quoted Eihei Dogen. For those of you who don't know, he was a Japanese priest who lived from 1200 to 1253. He's considered the founder of Soto Zen. He did quite a bit of writing about practice and life, and his writing is considered very important in our tradition. So one of the things he did, he took the common phrase mind-body, and he switched it to body-mind, believing that in order to realize your true nature, Buddha nature, it's most effective to train the body. So, and here's what he said. If the body moves and acts in accordance with respect and non-waste and treats everything as one interrelated whole, the mind will naturally experience compassion. So you can think wonderful thoughts, but if your body doesn't act accordingly, your true nature won't be manifested. And so and many of the rituals mentioned in this book are physical rituals. And as a great day-to-day example, house cleaning can be treated as a ritual. And here's a phrase Paula Arai uses that I really like. She says, with a full body and mind effort, polishing the floor polishes the heart. So I want to just give you a couple of examples from the book of the rituals that the women were doing at home. One woman who had a lot of chronic pain, arthritis, and some pain from injuries, found that if she sat down and took a piece of paper and copied the Heart Sutra on another piece of paper. This is the Heart Sutra is one of the chants that we did tonight in Sino-Japanese. But if she copied that, she had a lot less pain. So she would copy the Heart Sutra on a new piece of paper two or three times a week just to get relief from her chronic pain. Another woman in her 60s was diagnosed with abdominal cancer and told that it was inoperable. And this woman had a very strong relationship with an abbess at a local Zen temple. And she had a couple of cleaning cloths that the abbess had written calligraphy on, including the drawing of hands in gassho. And she asked the abbess to bless these cloths, and she had a firm belief that these cloths would heal her. So she, a couple times a day, would lay down and she put one cloth on a pillow and laid on it, put her head on it, put the other cloth at the site of her cancer, and 10 years later, her cancer was gone. And then I'm gonna give you one more example. In Japan, it's a commonly held belief that when a family member dies, they become a personal Buddha to the surviving loved one, to the loved ones in their family who are still alive. So many people in Japan have an altar at home, and they put pictures of their deceased relatives on the altar, and then they regularly make offerings of tea and incense and food, and sometimes they have conversations with their relatives. So here's an example from the book. One woman named Honda-san comes back to her studio apartment and calls out, "I'm home." And she's using the common Japanese phrase that family members use when they're either coming home or going out of the home. But Honda-san lives alone. And she's addressing the photos of her parents on her home altar. Now, her parents died more than 30 years ago, but she considers them her family. And here's what she said. My heart hears their response. Your return home is welcomed. With this ritual into the empty apartment, I know that I am not alone. In discussing the ritual, Honda-san explained, in my home, I have my parents' pictures. I give flowers, water, and food. When I leave, I ask them to take care of the home, and I say I am leaving and I will be back. I have not felt a sense of loneliness. So I really liked that. I liked the whole idea of putting your deceased relative's pictures on the altar. I read this book a few years ago, and I decided I would do that at home. So I have a picture of my father, an aunt, and an uncle. I have Carolyn's parents, my wife's parents on the altar, and her brother. And they're in the meditation room, and it's really nice to meditate with them. I often, just kind of look at the pictures and think about these people. Once in a while, I'll have a little talk with them. I reflect on how they live their lives, how they face their death, some of the things they did that, you know, I feel grateful for. And I just overall have a much, I would say, better and closer relationship with them than I would if, you know, I just had their picture on the wall in the living room. So it's been a really neat experience to do it. And I was really pleased to find out about this tradition and this ritual from the book. So that's really all I have to say about ritual, a little bit about what we do here and some of the things that they do in Japan. And I think there's maybe a little encouragement for us to maybe think about rituals that we might want to bring into our lives. I don't have a watch, but I think we have time.
It's 20. Yeah.
How much?
17 till. Yes.
Oh, okay. So we have time if people have questions or comments or anything, either about things I've said or what Chris has said. We'd love to hear from you.
John?
Yes.
Have you thought about this? I find ritual, once it's learned, to be very helpful in single-mindedness. Because when you're doing something, and it could be getting up in the morning or taking a shower or whatever, or chanting in here, the mind, you don't have to ask, well, what's next? Mm-hmm. You're not faced with that decision constantly. Mm-hmm. What's next? What's next? You're always thinking about what I'm doing right now. Mm-hmm. What is the next thing?
Mm-hmm.
I saw that pretty clearly during one of our nation's camping trips. We spent 6 months in the desert in Saudi Arabia. And you would get into a routine. And that routine, you just did the next thing. I mean, it would just, and I would talk to some of my friends and say, well, you know, when I get home, I'm going to get on the Harley, I'm going to ride through the trees, you know, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, after 6 months, we went home. About a month later, I called some of them. And what was really funny is that to a man, including myself, none of us had done a single thing because we didn't know which to choose.
Uh-huh, yeah. There's actually a whole book written about that called The Paradox of Choice. This guy goes in to buy a pair of jeans that had worn out, and the clerk, well, do you want, you know, loose fit, tight fit, you know, low riders, stone washed, and he goes, but I, you know, listening to you, I think about, like, at a meditation retreat, you get up at a certain time, you go to the meditation hall, you eat at a certain time. And then I compare that to a day at home, and I'll get up, well, let's see now, what do I want to do today? And I mean, I could have that question several times a day, but you don't even have to ask that question during a meditation retreat. So the form and the ritual really is helpful to clear your mind of that. Yeah, I think you're right.
To a certain extent, I think it's, when I'm meditating, know, the thoughts are coming in, and so I'm split.